Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th day of February. Our guest this hour is the author of Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for New Answers. Roy Richard Grinker writes early in the book, parents still struggle to find appropriate placements for their autistic children. They fight with school systems, even hire lawyers, and file complaints and lawsuits. But the autism epidemic means that a newly diagnosed child is no longer a mystery, and no psychologist with even 1 or 2 years' experience could say that he or she has never seen a child like Isabel. Isabel is his daughter who is autistic. Whether or not we want to believe the idea that there is an epidemic, one thing is evident. Autism is more familiar and visible than ever before, and this is true no matter where you are, whether you're in a suburb of Washington, D.C., or in Seoul, Cape Town, or the hills of northern India. And he has been in all of those places in researching this book, partially because of the nature of what he does. Roy Richard Grinker is a professor of anthropology and director of the Institute for Ethnographic Research at George Washington University. He is editor-in-chief of Anthropological Quarterly, and he has two children. His daughter is now 15 years old, and she is autistic. And he describes Isabel, the autistic daughter's sister, Olivia, who's 13, is like a third parent here. It's just a really fascinating book, and we're going to talk about autism this hour. And welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Hello, Roy.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us. You know, I was really struck. We were talking to somebody last week whose brother was autistic and grew up in the 1950s, and he never left the house. He never went to school. He was a brilliant, you know, World War II historian, actually, but you couldn't do a darn thing, and that wasn't very long ago, was it?
No. It was a very strange time back in the 1950s. I was born in 1961 in Chicago, and I remember when I was growing up that even if somebody had a math tutor, even if somebody, you know, needed a little extra help at school, it was hush-hush, let alone if somebody mm-hmm. was seeing a psychiatrist. So mm-hmm. parents tended to hide their kids at home, not only because they were ashamed, but because the public wasn't very receptive to them. And I believe it was the late 50s that Eric Erickson, the guru of child psychology, had a child with Down syndrome, immediately sent him to an institution for the rest of his life. And when he and his wife came home from the hospital, they told their remaining siblings that remaining kids that the child had died at birth.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that something? When did we start learning more about autism and advancing in this field? Was it that people used to be diagnosed with just this blanket mental retardation?
Well, mental retardation was certainly one of the diagnoses given to people with autism, but it actually wasn't as common as some other diagnoses. There were a whole slew of strange phrases like brain disorder or emotional block, very vague terms. And a very common diagnosis as well was childhood schizophrenia. Now, today, people don't think that childhood schizophrenia is very common at all. In fact, there are only a handful of cases that have ever been found over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. But back in the 1960s and even in the 1970s, you would find files of thousands of kids at various hospitals who were diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only mention of the word autism in the old American psychiatric manuals all the way up to 1980 was in the criteria for childhood schizophrenia.
Oh,
you couldn't even find the word autism anywhere else.
Uh-huh. Tell me when you realized that the Isabel was having problems and how old she was when she was diagnosed and how she became diagnosed with autism.
Well, Isabel, like a subset of kids with autism, seemed to be developing language appropriately for the first couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But then by 2 years, it was clear to us that she was pulling back, that she was losing some of the words that she had had.
Mm.
And by the time she was two, she had about 70 words in her vocabulary, but they were all nouns, and they were all names of toys, like Thomas the Tank Engine trains or Disney characters. She couldn't put two words together, and those nouns that she knew didn't include mommy and daddy. Mm. She couldn't say yes or no. So she really couldn't communicate.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, she had increasingly poor eye contact. She flapped her arms. She just couldn't respond to her name. And we really knew something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very worried.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a complete portrait of her in the book. You read the book and you say, I want to be her next-door neighbor. I want her to come over to my house and play with the dogs and talk about, you know, animal classifications. I mean, there's so much depth to her in many ways, isn't there?
There is. This is one of the really amazing things about, you know, the difference between, say, a memoir and a book that is more of a medical book. Once you meet somebody with autism, no matter how closely they fit that classification, the longer you know them, the more you realize they're ordinary people in some ways. I mean, they're ordinary people because they have their own personalities and their own senses of humor and their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are similarities in the range of people that have autism. But you get to know people like her classmates do or like the kids who are in her school do or our neighbors, and you start to see, you know, a real person, and you can't imagine there any other way. It used to be that I would think, what would Isabel be like if she didn't have this or that
mm-hmm.
problem? And now it's more like this is our daughter, this is who she is.
Right. And tell me about where she's 15 years old now. Tell me about where she is in school, and I know that this has been a struggle for you for many years about
yeah.
with camp programs and pressure in school. What kind of schooling situation does she have, Roy?
We're really fortunate to be in a fairly wealthy school district. I mean, they have seemed to have enough money to have some classroom aid support. And so she's in a special education program where she's in classes that are all 8 to 10 students, and then there's at least one aide in the class along with the teacher. But it's contained within a mainstream school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important because even if her classes are kind of self-contained, it means that when she goes to school and leaves school, when she goes out to the playing fields, when she goes to the assemblies or to lunch, she's interacting with the kids who are in our community. And these are the people that we see at our local pool club, or the people we see at the shopping mall.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a good situation. I can't say that it's always ideal, you know. You have a good situation, and then the next semester there's a new teacher who doesn't get your kid.
Right.
And you end up fighting again.
Right. Or a new parent who doesn't, not you, or a new parent of somebody else in the class who doesn't get your kid and starts to complain, right?
Well, that used to be a big problem when she was younger and parents were more involved in the classroom. Once the kid gets to high school, you know, parents are less involved, so they complain less. But you're right. We used to have situations where we would have her in some class or in a camp situation, and a parent would complain and say, I don't want my child to be with this child who's clearly disruptive or disabled or however they wanted to portray her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it's like to have a young child again with autism in this year, 2007, but I would imagine it's better than when we had a young child in the 90s.
Right. The other, another part of the big part of the book is when you go to places like India and South Africa, and let's go to Korea here because I'm wondering how much things have changed. You paint this just deplorable picture of this family, and the mother is, you know, the in-laws blame her for the autism in the family, and nobody comes to the house, and the child doesn't go to school, and the father takes no responsibility. It sounds terrible.
Yeah. It's upsetting to see. I do try to point out in the book that things are changing in Korea,
mm-hmm.
and they seem to be changing fairly rapidly. But one of the problems in Korea is that people are so concerned with the integrity of the family line that they don't want there to be any public knowledge that there might be anything wrong or anything genetically wrong with the family. And so, for example, autism is rarely diagnosed in Korea.
Hmm.
And one reason is that these kids are being diagnosed with something else, which is called reactive attachment disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's in the United States diagnosed very rarely, mostly for kids who've had pretty severe and demonstrable abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
or even abuse where they failed to attach to any caregiver, often people who were in large orphanages with poor care. But what it means in Korea is that the mother is to blame. It's not that unlike the United States back in the 50s and 60s. And the mother, this is what's remarkable, the mother accepts blame. And she's happy to accept blame. Because if they say it's autism, that means the whole family is impugned.
Oh, my.
Whereas if it's just the mother, well, then the rest of the family at least is safe.
Oh, my. And in other places, the mother, I think this was the case in India, Roy, where the mother knew that there was something wrong and really fought despite the fact that relatives wanted to take the child to, I don't know, the doctors who were going to perform some kind of weird magic on them. Some mothers who really go to extremes and great personal sacrifice to make sure their child is taken care of.
They do. They'll travel far away from their home.
Yeah.
In India, one of the problems was that the mother-in-law blamed herself. She didn't blame her daughter-in-law. She blamed herself for not doing the proper sacrifices. And so the mother wanted to act, and the mother-in-law wanted to act, and they struggled over who would take responsibility. I think one of the key things underlying people's reactions throughout the world to autism is this concept of blame. It's like people always want to find somebody to blame.
Right, right.
I mean, in this country, people are looking for things to blame, vaccines or environmental toxins. In India, in South Africa, they're looking for somebody to blame, or they're just looking at themselves. I suppose that's kind of a natural tendency when something goes wrong in a family.
Let's welcome phone calls. We're going to get Roy on another line here, too. I don't know if it's a speakerphone or what, but there's a little bit of an echo I'm hearing. I don't know if you're hearing, but we'll try and get rid of it. Roy Richard Grinker is our guest. Maybe some of you have had a chance to read his very absorbing book, Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for New Answers. The book looks at their families. Fight for Isabel, his daughter with autism, getting services for her the moment she was diagnosed, getting a lot of doctors together and other professionals. And this was when autism was not a popular diagnosis back in 1994. Some of you listening, I'm sure, will have perhaps horror stories to tell of people who were living with autism in the years before that, particularly in the 1950s, where nothing was done at all for people with autism. And the book also, though, looks at how autism is being treated and thought of in other cultures in the world, like Korea and India and South Africa. We certainly welcome your phone calls for Roy Richard Grinker. Our number is 800-486-8655. He is the professor of anthropology and director of the George Washington University Institute for Ethnographic Research, also the author of a number of other books, including In the Arms of Africa, The Life of Colin Turnbull. He lectures at many universities and to parents and professionals who are involved with autism. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Roy Richard Grinker. His book is Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for New Answers. Let's talk about the numbers for just a moment before we go to phone calls. Newspapers, lots of stories on autism. Newsweek, Time, cover stories on autism. We're hearing about this explosion in autism. Can you talk about reported autism prevalence and what the numbers are showing you, Roy?
Yeah, the best estimate that we have right now is 1 in 166. Now, I suspect, but we don't know for sure until publications come out, but I suspect that number may even go up as methods get better. And here's really what happened, that with the rise of psychopharmacology and, you know, the development of drugs for mental illnesses, psychiatrists had to come up with more reliable and valid criteria so that they were sure when they were testing a drug, they were testing it on the same symptoms, the same illnesses. And at the same time, the scientists who study the distribution of illnesses in a given population, epidemiologists, started to count better. They started to use these new criteria. Instead of just looking at administrative records and seeing whether someone was listed and classified as autistic,
mm-hmm.
they did their own diagnoses. And they were more rigorous about it and more aggressive
hmm.
to try to really capture the total number of cases. Now, a third thing is happening in addition to the development of drugs and better counting methods, and that is that the range of what one called autism increased dramatically, so that it could include a very high-functioning person, maybe even a university professor, who's married and has kids, but also someone who is profoundly mm-hmm. mentally retarded and needs to live mm-hmm. in a residential institution. So today, when you hear that rate, 1 in 166,
mm-hmm.
it's a good rate in terms of, you know, it's not the use of science to come up with that rate. It's the best, most accurate we have. And it is also a rate that includes that much larger spectrum than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
So you really can't compare it to, say, a rate in the 1960s. So you can't say, well, in 1960 it was 3 in 10,000 and now it's 1 in 166. It's really comparing apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm. And how do you define it, Roy? How do you define autism?
Well, autism is a developmental disorder that involves speech delay, usually. If not speech delay, always moderate to severe problems in communication. And it's also accompanied by restricted activities and interests. For example, in the my daughter, who was only interested in Thomas the Tank Engine trains, and even if there was a certain train, she might only be interested in the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And it also involves sensory deficits and sensory problems where people can't handle certain sounds that you or I may not think is are problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a range of different symptoms, and some have these symptoms very severely. They don't talk at all. Others have these symptoms in a more moderate way, and they change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly throughout adulthood, they change as well.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who was severely impaired as a 2 or 3 year old may actually not look so impaired once they get to be 20, 30, 40 years old.
Mm-hmm. You say in the book you want Isabel to have minimal emotional distress, to be able to continue learning as an adult, to know how to advocate for her needs, and how to make friends. You think that's likely?
I hope so.
Hmm.
I definitely want her to advocate for her needs, because that's, of all those things that you said, I mean, I think it's a really important thing. I'm a professor, as you said at the outset, and I have had students who are on the autism spectrum who've had a diagnosis of Asperger's disorder. But I don't necessarily know this, you know, if I'm lecturing to a big class. I don't know that. But sometimes a student will come up to me and say, I have Asperger's disorder. You may notice I won't be making eye contact with you.
Hmm.
I'm even going to be doing crossword puzzles during the lecture. It's not because I'm not listening.
Huh.
It's part of my disorder. And, you know, that makes me a better teacher.
Hmm.
Because then I don't
right.
look at this
right.
person and think, you know. And so I applaud whoever got him to learn how to advocate for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's pretty extraordinary, you know, and a person on the autism spectrum going to George Washington University. He's doing really well, obviously.
Yes.
But I think that even at other levels, just being able to say to somebody, whether it's a policeman or a clerk at a store, I don't communicate well, I need this or that.
Right, right. Let's go to phone calls. David from DeSoto is our first caller. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Hello.
I have a question, a comment, and then a question, please. My comment is that I think anyone that has a child or a friend or any family member or whatever that has been diagnosed in any way should look into the MK-ULTRA trauma-based mind control experiments that were conducted primarily by a foreigner named Ewan Cameron. And that's my...
Are you familiar with this, or is this taking a...
No, David, I'm not familiar with it, but I appreciate you mentioning it.
Yeah. Sorry, David, we just can't have a conversation about things we don't know very much about. Tony from Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
I was actually calling Richard. You spoke briefly on summer camps, and I wanted to have a better understanding of what type of summer camp you sent your daughter to. Were the staff trained and skilled in this type of... childhood development, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question, because the summer is a really big issue for parents. you know, they have these educational programs that they that the kids can be in during the school year, and all of a sudden summer hits, and you can't quit your job and just stay home. You have to do something with your kid. And there are camps out there that I don't know if they market themselves exactly for, you know, quirky kids, but they tend not to be overnight camps. They tend to be day camps, and often the camps are the camps that are at schools. So they might be at private schools in your area, independent schools that have summer camps where they have a variety of activities that the students can do, and some will work well and some won't. For my daughter, for instance, going to a day camp at a local private school's summer program involved finding the right types of classes for her. Most of the teachers at summer camps, the counselors, if they're not high school students or college students, they're actually teachers from the public schools who are doing this during the summer, and so they've had experience with special needs. Now, we couldn't put Isabel in something like, say, basketball, because that's so social, involving teamwork, she couldn't handle it. Mm. But we could put her in art classes, a puppetry class, where she made puppets and learned to act out stories. And even in very elementary foreign language classes, which is very unusual. I mean, nobody would say a kid with a language and communication problem should learn a second language. But as I talk about in the book, learning a foreign language, at least at the elementary level, is like speech therapy, because the language is broken down. There are these small social interactions. Hello, hello, how are you? I'm fine. And those, we had Isabel in a French class, and it was extremely helpful for her because she just sort of learned some of the basics of social interaction.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Dale from La Crosse. Hi, Dale.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have, over the last 6 or 8 months, have come across a variety of places and people who have indicated that, and books indeed, that have indicated that there are certain dietary aspects to the development of autism and to the retention of autistic sorts of behaviors. And the first one was when I was reading a book about gluten-free diets. And then the second time was when I was reading a book called Restoring Your Digestive Health. I've myself have got digestive problems. Now, and then the third time is that I'm only in Wisconsin for a short time, and I'm a translator. I translate from Dutch to English. And one of my clients is a person who's done a whole lot of biochemical research on blood analysis. And he, when I last spoke with him, he indicated that, among other things, that there, in doing blood analysis, when he was analyzing the blood of pregnant women, he was able, with a high degree of predictive accuracy, able to find blood markers in the blood of pregnant women that showed a sort of prediction or a precursor that would let him know that an autistic child was very likely to be born.
Okay, Roy, your response?
Yeah, let me just mention, I'll take your first comment first about diet. What you're noting there is something which is very common, that parents will try different dietary restrictions, and it's really trial and error because we don't have, there are not good scientific data that, say, a gluten-free or a casein-free diet really has that much of an effect on the autistic symptoms. But dietary changes, definitely, I've heard doctors and parents tell me, can make a change in the gastrointestinal problems. And there is a group of kids with autism that have gastrointestinal problems. Probably not as big as you might think, but that does exist. And I have seen people in South Africa, Central African Republic, in Korea and India, all talk about how they've used different diets, changes in whether it's sugar or flour and so on, and seen changes. Now, we just don't have the scientific data on it. Some studies are being done. Now, on whether there are any blood markers that can suggest autism as something that will emerge, I do not know of any peer-reviewed publications, scientific evidence that there is has been any kind of laboratory test for identifying either autism or susceptibility to autism.
Mm-hmm.
Autism is still defined, still identified through behavioral observation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, anywhere you are in the world. It's a very genetic disorder. I mean, the role of genes in autism is probably greater than any illness I know of.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Roy Richard Grinker is our guest. His book is Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for New Answers. There's one very poignant scene in the book where you're looking at Isabel and you're with her because sometimes autistic children have a hard time going to sleep. And so you're sitting in her room and you do this frequently and watch her go into slumber. And it made me realize that it must be a great deal of hard work to be a parent of an autistic child. You just have to be on the lookout a lot, don't you? There's just a lot going on all the time. And to see her peacefully go into slumber is such a transition.
Yeah, it can be tiring, very, very tiring. But it's actually amazing how quickly you can forget how tiring it was. It's sort of like, I suppose
the pain of childbirth. Oh, I forgot. I think I'll have another child.
I forgot how much that hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What we really try to do, and sometimes we're successful, and sometimes we're not. My wife and I really try to look at Isabel over the long term. I mean, if you were to have come into our house yet last night at 9 o'clock, you probably would have heard some yelling. She didn't want to take a bath, right? And it was a huge struggle. And you'd look and say, well, this is terrible. You know, this must be so hard. But if you look at the longer term, the fact that she can actually eventually get in a bath, which she couldn't do for a while because she was so phobic of water, that is an achievement. And we try to take rewards in looking at how far Isabel has come rather than focusing on those moments of hardship.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that by comparing her to herself, by comparing your son to his self, rather than comparing them to, you know, some imagined norm of what a child should be like.
Right. And tell me a little bit about Olivia and how she fits into all of this. You've said that she's like a third parent. What do you mean? This is your other daughter.
Yeah. Sometimes that's good that she's like a third parent. And sometimes I think she tries to take too much responsibility and we have to tell her, wait a minute, you're just her little sister. Mm. Olivia's 13, and she has actually many of the features that I've always thought were the stereotype of an only child. Sort of more comfortable mingling with adults, a little bit more mature, perhaps, than I would have expected at her age, overly responsible, remembering things I have to do rather than my having to remember them. And I think that's because in some ways she has been an only child. There has just been such minimal interaction, particularly in Isabel's early years with her sister, that she was raised to join in and help with the responsibilities. And, of course, like any parent, I'm ambivalent about what her role would be in Isabel's later life. I don't necessarily want Isabel to depend completely on Olivia and Olivia to have to be to shoulder that obligation later when we're not around anymore, my wife and me.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, when I talk to Olivia about it, she, even at the age of 13, seems eager and interested to be with Isabel and to care for her later.
Hmm.
I found families in India, actually, that had an extra child just to have a caretaker for their child.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that something?
I mean, the whole purpose of that child, and the child knows this from the time they're, you know, able to speak and communicate, that's going to be their role in life.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, well,
yeah.
That's not something I really agree with.
Uh-huh.
I want Olivia to be able to be free and to do what she needs to do and wants to do in the world. There's a story that I tell in the book about Paul McEnroe, who's an award-winning reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And he's a really interesting person because he takes care of his two autistic brothers who are in their 50s. But he's managed to become a war reporter and he goes off to faraway places, and he's kind of found a way to combine both being able to take care of them and also pursuing his dream.
He doesn't sleep. That's the answer, right?
Don't you think? Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard.
It is tough.
It's amazing what people can do.
But on the other hand, I don't think we should go to a situation where we say, oh, well, a child should just be able to do whatever they want to. I mean, you're born into a family. There is such a thing as family obligation.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in East Asia, nobody would say that a child ought to be able to grow up and do absolutely everything they want to do independent of their family obligations.
Right.
I mean, certainly in the Confucian world, that wouldn't fly.
Yeah. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Jerry is next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I was diagnosed when I was 14 as having Asperger's,
mm-hmm.
which I know from what I've been told is, you know, just basically a variation on autism. And my doctor has told me is that I was genetically predisposed to have autism, but the onslaught of mercury into my system could have been the straw that broke the camel's back. When I was younger, my parents used a product called Mercuricome.
Mm-hmm.
It was the, you know, no sting alternative to rubbing alcohol to make everything better. And, I understand that that's a mercury derivative. And that I was wondering if you had any comments on mercury being, you know, maybe not the a cause, but something that can, you know, make it worse.
How are you doing now before we get an answer to that?
Well, they had me on several treatments. One is trace mineral drops, which absolutely do wonders. And the other was lots of mud baths trying to cleanse my system of the mercury that was in there. Right now I, you know, hold a successful job as, you know, in a technical field. I'm married, I have a kid on the way, and own a home.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 21, so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes I wonder if getting the diagnosis was helpful to you, Jerry. Did it kind of help you make sense of what your personality was like?
I was misdiagnosed as having ADD.
Uh-huh.
I always had problems with bathing and social interaction and, you know, a lot of the, you know, telltale signs of kids having autism, but the school that I went to, nobody recognized it as autism. They recognized it as, oh, this kid's hyper, he has ADD.
Right.
Let's try and stick him on Ritalin.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If you look at the autism prevalence rates in, for example, the state of Minnesota, which is next to you guys, you find that autism increases in terms of school classifications and administrative records all the way up to age 15. So people are getting newly diagnosed at 13, at 14, at 15. Those tend to be, you know, either re-diagnoses or people with Asperger's disorder who might have sort of slipped through the cracks. And kids with Asperger's disorder are just getting so much more better care these days,
mm-hmm.
Than ever before. On the subject of mercury, you know, one of the things that I am very committed to as a researcher is evidence-based science.
Right.
And there are many hypotheses that are out there about the role of mercury, and particularly the role of a mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal that was in many vaccines but has not been in vaccines in the United States since 2002. At least in 2002, maybe 2% of all vaccines on the shelves had some traces of thimerosal. But there has never been any good scientific data to show that vaccines or anything that was in vaccines, such as mercury, has been related to autism or to changing rates in autism. There continue to be people working on this, but as of yet, you know, if you were to look at the peer-reviewed journals, the excellent peer-reviewed journals, we don't find any evidence for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost gotten to the level of an urban legend,
mm-hmm.
that somehow mercury is involved. And there are anecdotal reports here and there, and Jerry's is certainly, an anecdotal report that ought to be listened to as an anecdote. But in terms of the scientific data, we just don't have it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's tell some Isabel stories, because you've got great stories in this book. Let's talk about dogs and your very interesting trip to France, which was in some ways kind of a life-changing event for Isabel. Can you talk about that?
She was terrified of dogs.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrified. I mean, she would see a dog coming 100 yards away, and she would start screaming and running, and we'd have to grab her so she wouldn't run into the street.
Mm.
At the same time, she developed a kind of fixation on a book, a fantastic book. The author's names I can't recall, but the title is Linnea in Monet's Garden.
Mm.
And she became fixated on it, and it was clear she wanted to go to Monet's Garden.
Mm.
She was now able to start speaking, and at age 7, 8, she's telling us she has to go there.
Mm.
She started to dress like that character.
Oh.
And we thought, how can we take her to France? There are dogs everywhere. It's going to be terrible.
Right.
And we took her to France. It's kind of extravagant, obviously, but, you know, one of the things you do when you have a kid with autism and they have restricted interests is you try to build on those interests. And so we brought her and her sister to Monet's Garden, and all of a sudden she started to relax. And I don't know what it was, but I describe it in the book, that when she got to Monet's Garden, we saw this kind of change in her.
Mm.
And she wanted to know how to say, is your dog nice, in French.
Mm.
And we gave her those words, and she started to go up to people and ask them if their dog was nice, and she would pet the dog. She must have petted 100 dogs. And it was remarkable. How could this take place? But it was as if leaving the country, going to this unusual place, stepping inside the world of this character kind of ignited something, or it was a jolt to her system.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you can do electroshock therapy, or you can, you know, put him in an entirely foreign context, I guess. And it did something to her. You know, it's one of these inexplicable things that, you know, my 13-year-old seems to make progress sort of, you know, a typical way, inch by inch. But Isabel seems to go level for a long time, and then there'll be some sort of jolt through the system. And now she not only loves dogs, but she has a dog. And she loves animals, and we're trying to get her involved in our local zoos to see that if she can volunteer in some way.
Mm-hmm. She has a French bulldog, too, right?
She has a French bulldog.
Yeah.
The name of the French bulldog is Linnea.
I love the story.
Which is the name of the character in the Monet's Garden story that I tell. I have a little excerpt. I think I might have an excerpt of that on my website.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. And she's this expert in animal classification to a remarkable extent, right?
Yeah, well, one thing people on the autism spectrum can do, if they can do anything, is they can do classifications and categorization and lists and memorization. And she, you know, you can tell her almost any animal and she'll give you the species name.
Isn't that something?
And so, you know, that's interesting and it's a joy. You don't want to let your kid just be focused on that.
Right.
You know, you want
right.
to move them. So if she's right. obsessed with this book, Linnea in Monet's Garden, how do we move her out of it? Well,
right.
we take her to the museum and show her a painting by Monet.
Uh-huh.
Or we take her to France and take her to Monet's Garden. If she got fascinated with Lance Armstrong, we'd probably, you know, take her to a bicycle race. You try to build on things and move out so that your kid isn't just rewinding the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I understand. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 227-2050. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Roy Richard Grinker. His book is Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for New Answers. He's a professor of anthropology and the director of the George Washington University Institute for Ethnographic Research. And let's go to Holly next from Oak Creek. Hi, Holly.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. I have a daughter who was 29 years old, who is 29, and was diagnosed with autism when she was probably about 17 or 18, just shortly before she got out of the high school. And before that time, she had been diagnosed or had been labeled as with an undiagnosed form of mental retardation.
Oh.
And my husband had three siblings with Down syndrome, one who died.
Three siblings, really?
Yeah. And a brother who just recently died at age 45, and he has a sister who's still 58 and still living with Down syndrome.
My.
But when our daughter was born, after about a year, she wasn't progressing, you know, as we expected. We were wondering if there was some relation to the Down syndrome, and of course we said, well, you either have Down syndrome or you don't, and there wasn't any relation. And so when your guest mentioned that there was there's a genetic predisposition to autism, I didn't understand what he meant or what that information entails.
Okay, I can answer that. The genetics of autism has been studied in part through looking at identical twins, and scientists have looked at what is called concordance in identical twins, like what percentage of identical twins would both have an autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take identical twins who have the identical DNA, the concordance of an autism spectrum disorder is between 80 and 90% in the most studies.
Hmm.
Now, if you look at fraternal twins, where obviously they don't have the identical DNA,
right,
the concordance of an autism spectrum disorder is between 0 and 10%. So now that 80, 90%, you can compare it to other disorders like heart disease, breast cancer, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, where at the most you're probably going to see a 60% concordance. So we're talking about a very strong, strong genetic component to autism.
Okay.
Now, in terms of different diagnoses, like your daughter getting one diagnosis when she was younger and then another when she was 17, 18. Autism diagnoses can be made irrespective of cause. In fact, the whole manual of the American Psychiatric Association is filled with disorders that are diagnosed not on the basis of cause, but on the basis of symptoms.
Right.
So back in the 1950s, someone with Down syndrome would never have been given a diagnosis of autism. But sometimes now, there are people with Down syndrome who are given a diagnosis of autism.
Oh, sure.
Back in the 50s and 60s, if you had seizures, you couldn't get an autism diagnosis. If you had mental retardation, you often couldn't. If there was any clearly definable medical reason for your disorder, you couldn't. So things have changed considerably now, and so your daughter's autism may have an entirely different cause from somebody else's autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the diagnosis, that may not make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. It's
very, very genetic.
Puzzle, because she didn't have a diagnosed form of mental retardation. We mm-hmm. could never find out what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we searched. She was tested for every metabolic disorder to find out problems. And yet, as she got older, all of these unusual behaviors, the things that you're talking about with your daughter, were present. I mean, she hates to take a shower to this day. I have to still battle with her to take a shower. She mm-hmm. loves dogs. She loves golden retrievers, are her favorite. And, you know, her hearing is phenomenal. Mm. She just hears the airplanes going overhead. I mean, we used to call her middle name Radar, because she mm-hmm. could spot a plane in the sky faster than anybody else.
Mm.
And
yeah.
All of those things I understand make up autism, and that's why I felt like I had to get her diagnosed with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would explain her unusual behaviors rather than just a lower cognitive functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, and also autism helps give you the roadmap for what to do.
Right, right. Yeah, it's helpful to have the diagnosis. How is she doing now, Holly?
She's doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, she still is a challenge to live with. She's living with us, but she works at Goodwill, and they're wonderful there with her.
Right.
And you know, she has friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to, when she was younger, they termed it, or in school they termed it, you know, an abnormal. It was your original idea of autism was someone that didn't interact with people, and yet she interacted with people, but just in such an unusual way.
Right.
Yeah. She sticks a picture of her. She's got a favorite picture, and she sticks that in your face, and you're supposed to talk to the picture.
Oh, my.
But yeah. It's her husband. She calls it her husband.
That's really, that's nice.
Yeah, it is nice. Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Are there a special set of challenges for parents? This is, I'm sure, different from child to child, but what about adolescents and autism?
Yeah, adolescents can be tough. When I've gone around the country and into other cultures to interview people about their teenagers, boys in adolescence seem to be particularly challenging because of aggression and sexual interest and things of that sort, which get to be very, very difficult. And I think you might remember in the book I talk about a boy in India and some of the challenges his mother had and how she had to find very creative and quite unorthodox ways that I don't need to go into on the radio, but unorthodox ways in order to address the issue of him actually becoming a man.
Mm-hmm.
And her son was quite impaired, pretty profoundly mentally retarded.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the other problem is that once you're out of the school system, you know, at least in terms of the government, you're off the radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little frightening to think about what happens once your child is out of the public school age and what will happen. And so my recommendation to parents always is start early. Start as early as possible to think about it. I talk in the book about Maureen Fanning, and she is this...
what a story.
9/11 widow. She started early. Really, really early, when the kids were like 8, 9 years old, her twin boys with her two boys with autism.
Mm-hmm.
When they were like 8 or 9, she started to do organizing in her community to build group homes, so that by the time they got to be 18, 20, 22, there might be a group home for them to live in.
Mm-hmm. And then her husband is killed on 9/11.
Yeah, he was a... senior fireman. He was head of hazardous materials for the five boroughs area.
Mm-hmm.
And after his death, there was kind of an outpouring of generosity, and people donated a lot of money to the group home foundation that she had started. And this is in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, people with autism are benefiting from all of these heroic parents. Mm-hmm. And yes, I mean, you know, there are these heroes like Maureen Fanning who go out there and they build a foundation to build group homes. But then there are just the heroes like the woman who just called on the phone. I mean, the way that she talked about her daughter, I mean, you can sort of just over the radio, you know, not even in person, you can feel her affection and her love for her daughter and how much she thinks about what her daughter needs. And you know, the heroics that we find these days is even in those little minute things, like what one parent does to, like, you know, find a toilet that doesn't have a flush that drives their kid crazy.
Yeah.
You know, or to find a way to bathe their child that won't upset them, or whatever that might be. Find foods that they'll eat.
Yeah. One more phone call, running short on time. Paul from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I've got a 22-year-old boy who's autistic, and I retired from my job so I could take care of him. And he's gotten better as a result of the constant attention. But I really worry about what you do, you know, for planning for when you're not here. This city, as Kathleen, you probably know, has had scandals about
group homes. Yeah.
And only one journalist picked up on that, thank God for
Meg
her.
Kissinger, exactly. Great series of articles, yeah.
Fantastic. But you know, even the county board chairman was involved in renting substandard houses for people. And I just thought, you know, how do you plan for the future when there's "we could care less" is the motto of the community.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's a long series, but take it on for a minute if you would, Roy.
Sure. I mean, it's a tough question. The people that I talk to in other cultures, they say, oh, well, the extended family is the answer. And they look at America and they say, we hear that in America you've just got like a parent and kids living in the home. But in India or in South Africa, we have these extended families. There's more opportunity for care. Look at the elderly in the United States. You know, elderly go to nursing homes and to assisted living centers often, and they, you know, and even if you want your parent to live with you, sometimes they insist, no, I don't want to bother you. I want to live, you know, away independently. But we're talking about kids maybe living in group homes for 40, 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that I look at when I go to these other cultures is I think, you know, what have we lost that we don't have these larger communities to help integrate our kids into?
Thank you so much for being with us, Roy, and for having written the book. Thanks.
Well, thank you for having me.
Roy Richard Grinker, and the book is Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for New Answers. It has just been published by Basic Books, and there's a lot to the book because it covers Isabel and Joyce, his wife, and their other daughter, Olivia, and really paints this vivid portrait of Isabel, and then also looks at autism in other parts of the world and how other families in this country have been dealing with autism. So all from the perspective of an anthropologist, and that's what Roy is. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee. This show will repeat tonight at 10 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9, from 9 to 11. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.